Welcome back to another Conquest Corner, where I, and sometimes the other guys, go through everything we want to discuss related to Conquest Last Argument Kings from Parabellum Games. On this particular corner episode, we're going to go through why you should be playing City States. So, this is part of the series that I've been doing related to each of the factions, going over essentially basic fluff, army rule, units, playstyles that I see, why you might play them, and also importantly, why you may not. When we get into the fluff part, I will say I do try to do enough that gives you an idea of who they are without trying to go into too much of the detail. If you wanted the detail, you can read that they put up. There's a variety of other stories, but I just want to give a brief overview. Same thing when we talk about the rules, brief overview, some sort of list build ideas, ways to build out the army, all those sorts of ideas. So at this point, I've done all of them except for, once this one's done, Dwaghelm, which should be later this week. And Sorcerer Kings I've done a bunch for. I'll probably do one of these as well formally, but I might wait until they get a couple more releases. So maybe once at least the end of the month occurs, because as a filming of this is in April. Keep in mind, if you're looking to buy any Conquest whatsoever, we do have a code that you can use. It's put in the show notes below. It's Terrain Kickers is the code. There's also a link you click on to go there. Anything you buy from the Parabellum store is 10% off if you use our code. It also helps us out as well. So it does help us to be able to put on content like this and all the other sorts of things that we're trying to do as well. I said, the hope is actually one of the things we're going to be doing is filming some games this weekend, because we do actually have a tournament as of the time of hearing this. And I'll have that in the show notes as well, up to the time period of when it happens. All right, like you said, the goal of this one is to talk through City States. So let's get into their discussion. For anyone who maybe hasn't watched the other ones, we start with lore, we go through rules, we go through essentially sort of list build concepts, at least as I see them. It's never always inclusive, but at least gives you sort of a starting point, why to play them, why not play them, and then we'll talk about how to actually build out your army a little bit from a starting point. All right, let's get into it. All right, so for the city-states are essentially the Greeks when you take a look at it. This is, you know, antiquity Greece. And for these, they came about, unlike the Hundred Kingdoms, who kind of came from the fall of Capitus, the fall of the Old Dominion, Haslia's demise to some extent, when all of that happened. This was kind of foreseen a little earlier. So the city-states are essentially the brainchild of Constantinus Damoluxor, originally known as Platon. And we'll probably call him that more as we get on when we talk about him specifically, but I want to make sure we kind of know both of the names. So he was a humble man, but over time was able to become essentially the master of the College of Academics in the Old Dominion, or the Dominion at that time, later to become the Old Dominion. So he rose through the ranks and essentially became the head of academics, the library, the knowledge base. Maybe for all intents and purposes. He was on the secular side, not the religious side, because remember, Haslia is effectively a god, a bit of a primordial essence that has manifested itself into this power that in this world of Aya, you gain more power when you're primordial like this. You gain more power the more that people believe in you. Now, from this, he essentially with an unnamed underling, I believe they talk a little about who it is or his station, but they don't exactly name him. Through their research, they were able to uncover the secrets of the primordial and the divine. So they were able to understand essentially the formation of, for all intents and purposes, what humans would know it as is gods. What they also figured out, though, while doing this, is they were able to figure out what was going to happen. So they were able to see just the corruption and the inevitable fall that Haslia is going to undergo. And they had two different viewpoints. Constantinus, or Platon, as his original name was, his goal was to preserve what humanity had learned. So think in our own terms, the Library of Alexandria. If someone had known what was going to happen to the library, maybe through whatever sort of methods they would have, this was the person who was seeking out to preserve that knowledge in the best way they could. They assumed it would happen no matter what. There was no way to stop it. So save who you can, save what you can, and try to make sure humanity still has a good footing after this. his apprentice's goal was to actually stop it from happening. So the apprentice was trying to actually destroy Haslia. We know that these various religious sects and things like that are some of the reasons why the fall took place in the way it did, and essentially the smiting, although not real destruction, of Haslia and the destruction of Capitus and all of that was kind of edged on by all of this. So they essentially parted ways. One of the main driving factors for Platon is that he had learned essentially a creed of three things. That power corrupts. So in essence, these primordials, as more belief and all that's put into them, as these turned gods have more and more worshipers and believers, that will corrupt them over time. He also has that the belief is power. So belief is what gives them power. The more that people believe in the gods, the more powerful they become in this world. And that power calls power. So they want nothing more than to get more and more. That's part of the problem that happened with Haslia. Trying to get more supporters, he broke himself into all these various branches to feed on even more of this pull, which means he then was doing less for everyone and they believed him less and less and all of that. So he understood that to climb to a certain level is going to be nothing but a destruction at some point. As soon as you hit essentially a certain power level of a god, it's all going to be downhill from there. Sooner or later, there will be this fall. Well, to work with all this, he started a large-scale recruitment and info gathering, originally secretly, of artisans, sculptors, academics, of people of worth, or at least in his mind, worth. I don't know if he did it necessarily to exclude the masses, but much more in terms of they were the ones who were, they say, best and brightest and could usher in a new age for humanity. When the fall was imminent, very close, or had already started, then the secrets were gone. He was actively taking people and everything he could from the libraries, from all the knowledge bases that he could get his hands on. One other thing that he did, and this is important to what ended up happening to the States, is he stole part of the mantle of Haslia. And essentially, you know, the essence of primordial power, and he divided that among these city-states. So he took on the mantle, so this bit of being sort of a god, and he took primordial essence and he divided it piecewise into all these various city-states. And his hope was that if he divides it up enough, and he is good enough. So the more you are worshipped, the worse it gets. So if he can get people to believe in him, but have enough rational thought, so that way they don't go overboard, then he'll be able to usher in this new age. He essentially himself ascends to godhood of some level. In this, I don't know the exact intention of when they use those sort of words at all the times. So his thought was, hey, every city gets a piece of divinity. They're large enough to help the people to get something done, but not enough to overpower, and we're going to temper these people with essentially belief in science and secularism, or however you may put that, so that way it doesn't grow into fanaticism, which would empower these more, which would cause another downfall. That was his overall idea. Essentially, every city would be guided by a patron deity, and he was in essentially the main city to oversee all of this. Now, of course, this didn't work. Nothing, unfortunately, in the world actually ends up working out. So, a few reasons it failed. One, it was an incomplete transfer. So he was essentially transferring his essence and all of that to all these different cities. It didn't quite finish because it needed to happen before Haslia was struck down. Didn't happen. And it led to a fraction of their society. What happened is the city-states, much like the actual city-states of the Grecian era, they became their own little individual areas. They started warring and fighting so that they much more turned inward and outward hostility. Some of them became beholden to their patrons, others through their ruling councils that Platon had put in place, and others dove more into the academics and the structure that he originally wanted. So that's an overall breakdown of who they are. We'll get into the factions, and that will fill in some more of the pieces here. So let's start with the populist states. There's three of them. We'll start with the populist. The populists are the ones that effectively believe in democracy. So in Platon's idea, they were going to be ruled over by the Scholia. So they're going to be ruled over by essentially the scholars and sort of this group put together. And they would make sure that the path was followed as he intended. And again, the people would believe enough or get enough help from the primordial power, but they would always be there to make sure that people don't fall into dogmatic beliefs. What the populists did is they said, well, no, we think everyone should be equal. We think we should determine what happens to us, not you, not this primordial power, not essentially this chained deity, but it's our right to rule. Most of the countries in our world are democratic. That's essentially what the idea was. However, much more often what actually happened was more of an oligarchy. So the idea is everyone was supposed to be equal, and everyone was supposed to have equal say. And this is when you look at some Greek city-states, when you look at, you know, Athens and all, that was some of the idea of some of these. There was also all this idea of some people being more equal than others. And I don't want to get into too much of the historical thing, but it doesn't always quite work that way. The design was that the humans and the bread, so satyrs, minotaurs, all those sort of creatures, hey, everyone is nice and equal in our society. Everyone is welcome. However, like I said, that wasn't true. So if you watch the society more closely, you would see that, in essence, for someone to get power. So if you're a democracy, someone's still going to be, say, an elected official or elected officials. And what would happen is you had demagogues start to arise. So a demagogue, for anyone who doesn't know, it's someone who seeks power by trying to rile up your constituents against whoever is currently in power or the current leader or the current cases. So it was the idea of this person will come up and say, hey, they're not, I don't know, let's say just roads. I have to go with something simple. They're not fixing the roads. And that's the downfall of all that's happening here. If you elect me, if I'm the one in charge, I'll make sure they're fixed, and I'll fix every other problem they have and all of that. So you started having essentially these separate groups of people that were championing behind different people who were screaming why the current leaders, the current people in charge were bad, what was wrong with them. And if you get enough of them, then you become the leader. And then someone doesn't like the things that you've done, or now has, as soon as you do something vaguely unpopular, has maybe the wherewithal to pull all the people together, even your supporters, and start getting back at you. And if there was a problem with maybe some of the groups, say the bread, so maybe they start getting looked at as second class citizens. Maybe some of these, you know, the humans in some of these areas, they don't tend to go for what I want. So, hey, your ancestor had a problem, so we're going to remove your votes, or we remove your votes from you, and it has a lasting impression that the next generation of you will not get votes either. So you can start excluding people or excluding whole families. So it creates a caste system. So this idealized version of everyone being equal theoretically held, but in reality, it didn't work. And what really happened is it became purely a popularity contest of whoever can scream the loudest and hold down the most of their opponents can win. I do want to say, though, however, they do still prosper. They still do excel as city-states. They haven't fallen to disrepair. They haven't destroyed themselves in any way. So it comes in that question of, does the ends justify the means? If they're doing well as a people, does that mean what they did is truly wrong? Now, in reality, probably to an extent, but we're not going to get into the philosophical debates of all of that right now. All right, so what we're getting into now then is the Scholia. So this might explain, maybe I should have done these in a different order, but this is the order I chose. So to get into this, we have to talk a little bit about Platon himself. We mentioned it, but I want to make sure this is all clear. So his vision made manifest occurred in some of the places. So some of these cities, like Pallas, got exactly what he envisioned. It was a city with this primordial power, this patron deity helping the people, and the Scalia, essentially this council ruling over to make sure that the people stay in line and that his perfect vision is put forward. So his idea was that, well, if I want to save humanity, they're going to have to be drug kicking and screaming. He knew that people wouldn't give up essentially worship. That was essentially in our nature, at least as he saw it in our nature. We wanted to believe in something, so he wanted to give us something to believe in. So, like I said, he broke his consciousness into this council so that it was less likely to be corrupted. So Scalia is essentially his consciousness pulled apart, at least as I see it. There's some bits of this they don't, maybe they explain better in other spots, but there might be some bits that I'm missing. And again, if I do, the hope is it gives you a cool idea, and hopefully I don't say anything too wrong, but there might be some little bits here and there. The belief of the people would keep it all going, but no dogmatic faith would keep it in check. Hey, everything would work great. Over time, though, it failed. And it failed because of his hubris, and essentially he started to go mad. So this process, him becoming detached from his humanity, essentially as he became a god and split himself into pieces, he started to go insane. And the Scalia was more of the inhabitants of what he went to was chosen more for what it was than for fit and all of that. So slowly started to unravel itself. So some of the places, the people destroyed Scalia and became democratic. Those are the ones that we talked about. In other places, they lost faith to such an extent that the patrons' deities were actually able to ascend to godhood and take over control. And again, removing the Scalia. So the Scalia were his idea of this sort of governing council that rules off of logic and law and the ideas of perfection of humanity. And in some of these cities, it absolutely works. But the intention was for all of them. And we already talked about how some of them fell. And now we'll get into how the other ones did. So the last one is the religious states. So he put this primordial power in all these cities. The idea being, we'll keep it in check. And in some of these places, the people lost their faith in the Scalia. They lost their faith in this pragmatism. And instead, they started having faith much like they used to out of Capitus. They started more of believing in this primordial power, in this patron deity and all of that, and empowered it. When they rose to power in some of those locations, like I said, through worship or just distrust of the Scalia, I'm not going to go through all the different towns. They do mention some of these different city-states and what their patron deity slash turned god believed in and what they wanted and all. But essentially, they had different visions and views. Some of them were more for war. Some related to the sea. Essentially, if you go through the Greek gods, they had, if you look at enough city-states, there was a city-state with a patron deity of all these different aspects of Greek gods. So, you know, you have ones closer to Athena, to all of them, to Mars, or Ares, all of this sort of piece, depending on which name you know of. I know some are Greek and, you know, some are Roman, but I don't know everyone's background. But you essentially have that. Now, what I will say, it's actually a really interesting read, but to go through it, I would just have to be staring at with all the names and all the different towns and all of that. I don't think that makes a very interesting video, so I'm going to avoid doing that, but I will say that when you look at this overall, it shows you the changes that they had from, much like the city states there, where you have the belief in science, the belief in each other, and the belief in a higher power. That's essentially how the city states broke themselves out. All right. So that gives us a little bit about them. Again, like I said, there's more details to this, but I don't want to go too in depth with it because that's not the viewpoint of what I want here. I want to give you a taste of the lore, but I don't want to spend 2 hours doing it. There's some other people who do stuff like that, which is great, and I'd like to do more, but I just don't want to sit and read it to you. I don't find that interesting personally either. So not to that level. This level is fine, but not to the crazy level wise. All right, so let's talk a little bit about some rules then. City-states basically have two sets of rules. Now, when we talk about the rules, I want to talk about faction rules. What makes you distinct? Your units obviously make you distinct, but what's the big tie-over important piece? Two rules. First one is auxiliary stands. So some of the units, specifically things like hoplites and phalangites and all of that, but they can take auxiliary stands. So remember, this is a faction that, in their minds, they're humans and minotaurs and satyrs and essentially demi-humans, if you want to think about it that way, all mixed together. So they bring them to battle in some of these places who see them either as equals or as useful. Hey, stand and fight right alongside them. If you take an auxiliary stand, that means auxiliary stand, I should say. That means that you must put it in the front rank of your unit. So let's say it's a unit of hoplites that take it. So this one goes into the front rank. It does not count as a character stand. It's not a command stand, anything like that. It's just one of your stands. When the regiment does clashes, volleys, or charges, so when the regiment does something that could cause damage, the auxiliary stand does as well. So you'll notice the ones that listed here, the minotaurs, they have impact. They can fight, they have their own attack profiles, all of that. So when they fight off of their profile. So their clash numbers, their attacks, whether they cleave any special rules, they get it. They don't confer it to the unit unless it would be something that would, but doesn't. So they get essentially their rules. When you're rolling for defense, you'll notice here on the side, they have no resolve, they have no defense, no evade, because they count as part of the unit. So their defense will be related to the unit. If you have a shield, you still get your shield. But otherwise, you have the defense of the unit, you have the resolve related to the unit, you have the evade related to the unit, should they have it. So you're offensively yourself, you're defensively your regiment. You also count as the same class. So if you're in a medium, no matter what they count as, you are a medium if that's the unit that you're in. And you count for that for reinforcements, objectives, all those sorts of things. So you count as the class of your regiment. They said you're in the front rank. You're not a command stand. You can't be targeted specially. So they target the regiment. They don't target you. However, notice you do have wounds. So you can take wounds on these like you would anything else. They probably have more wounds than the other things. So it's a little bit more of safeguard. But they take wounds like anything else. They get destroyed like anything else. Difference is if they're destroyed, they cannot come back. So if you have ways to heal back up, nope, they're gone. And your size doesn't count as extra. So if the size of whatever it is, because these guys are technically brutes, so they can be a larger class, they don't count as that. They're the same size as normal infantry then for this purpose. So you can bring a little extra punch. Some of these units, especially multiple cleave and line breaker and all of that, you can get a little bit of extra hard hitting into these units. Especially if you take one that's maybe a little bit more defensive, you put some of that in. The other big rule they have is strategic stack. So this is the other thing that makes them who they are. All right. So in essence, what happens once per round when you're drawing your command card, instead of actually revealing it, so you can know what it is. Remember, you're allowed to see what's in your command stack. But instead of actually revealing it, you put it off the side. That is now your strategic stack, and then pass it back to your opponent. So you can skip an activation to save for an activation later. So you put a card off to the side. Later, after one of your friendly regiments or characters has gone, if you choose, right after they deactivate, so right after the two actions, all that is done, you may draw the card from your strategic stack. And then you get to activate, full activation, you get to activate that card. The card will count as inspired, no matter even if a rule would prevent it naturally, like phalanx and things like that. So they will always count as inspired. When that's done, then your opponent gets to go. That may not trigger any more card pull for activations after that point. They specifically mention that because remember now when a character goes afterwards, you can pull the card, and if that's the unit the character's in, it has not gone yet, they can go. This stops that. So whoever comes out of the strategic stack, even if it's a character, they can't trigger for another card. So this means this is an army where especially early in a round, when you're waiting for your opponent to do something, or what a lot of us do, I have a fighting character who I know won't get into combat because my unit's nowhere near close enough to be able to fight someone. oh, that character goes, pass your turn. You do that because you're essentially delaying tactics. I'm wanting you to do something. Let's say that's an important thing to do. Sometimes you want to act early, but sometimes you just want to wait. This is another way to be able to wait it out, and you could take that unit that needs to be able to activate at just the right moment, put them in your strategic stack, and then on one of your turns, when you truly need it, you can go and then go with that unit. That also means you can set them up well. So if you have put yourself in a position where they say they can't charge because you're in the way and you're going to block their being able to complete the charge nicely, then I can go with the unit that needs to get out of the way, charge with them, move them, whatever happens. And now I can go with this other unit. And they're automatically inspired. So even if they're already in combat, they can now say, just take their swings, kill out that unit. Now maybe they charge into someone else or reposition themselves. So those are the two main rules for them. That what adds a lot of the flavor to this faction. All right, so now that we went through some rules, let's go and take a look and talk about just some play styles and all that. Now, again, for all of this, I'm not trying to say they're the only play styles. I'm not trying to say these are the best. These are just ones that when I look through it, even at somewhat cursory glance, these are things that stand out to me or things that I like the look of. So your mileage very well may vary. And maybe after this, I mean, at the points this week, if I can, we wanted to start doing actually some list building segments. So I'd like to start that. I know Steve decided to talk some city states. So maybe we can get him on. We lose your record Wednesday. So maybe when we get him on and actually put together and kind of do a list for them. All right. Two play styles that I put here. The first one I called You Shall Not Pass. The whole idea of this is, one way that I see city-states play a lot is that they can be a very sort of tanky force or a very tough-to-shift style force. One thing, maybe it's less popular now because they have more units. It's especially popular early on when they didn't have nearly as many units, but now they have some more variety, so you might see it varied up more. But one thing you used to see was pretty big regiments, but running too wide, as far back as they want. Especially when we take a look at, in this case, if we're talking about Phalangites. Because Phalangites are support 3. They're actually 4 attacks now. At one point, they were as much support as they were attacks in a previous, I think when they first came out. But that means they're almost as good in support as they are in base. But if you have a smaller frontage, then your opponent doesn't get as many swings at you in general. Unless, you know, they could be 4 wide hit you well, but some people run a lot wider, or maybe because of their angle, they can't hit you quite as squarely. So it will help you out in general. It does mean you have some pretty big flanks, so you do have to be careful of that. So positioning is very important for this. But it does make them pretty survivable, especially if, and you can run a little wider if you need to related to it, but they also have pike formation. So, hey, if you're hitting them in that front, -3 the impact. For most things, that means no impact or only like an impact of 1. Unless there's a giant monster. But the things like when I think of my Cataphracti or I think of some other bigger units that are doing impacts 3 and 4 and that's really where they're dealing the damage, you're not dealing anything to Phalangites then. And notice, they don't get inspired or shock until the end of the round. So if you perform a charge in that front arc, you don't get any of those. So essentially, you get no bonuses. You're not getting through them then, or not realistically. With them, if you want to be able to give them some punch, because phalanx means you can't count as inspired unless you were pulled from the strategic stack, because the strategic stack specifically says you can. But otherwise, your phalangites, if you take a little artist, get flurry. So, yeah, you might still be on 2s, but 2s rerolling actually becomes better than a 3, maybe closer to almost a 4, depending on your dice rolls and all that. So you can still get some punch. Obviously, in this, if you want... Sorry, pause there briefly to look something up. Other options you have with this, sort of playstyle. So, Polemarchs, one of their tactics. Gives unyielding. So unyielding means your opponent can't take that objective unless you're broken, but otherwise your opponents don't take that objective from you. So you put it on, say, a unit like this, or even if you're looking at like a big old unit of hoplites, you can take the auxiliary. Then, hey, I'm grabbing this, either I'm taking this objective or at least you are not getting it. So you have that. You also have, if you're trying not to get moved, you have some other large blocks of monsters or monster type things you could run. Obviously you have 2 big boys. There it is. The Hephaestion and the Promethean. So when you're looking at these guys, 16 wounds with their 10 attacks, they have their spells. There's a special way in which they cast, but they do have their spells. So these, again, very tough to move with defense 3, 4 resolve. So you could have, units of those. The Minotaurs are always a good call because not only are they survivable enough, mostly because of the 6 wounds, they actually up their wounds. I believe they actually had decreased their price a little bit too, but they had upped their wounds because their defense isn't great, but their resolve isn't too bad because maybe you're running a little bit bigger. The big thing is they actually had the punch that you need. So if you're trying to make sure that your opponent doesn't get through you, you do need to be able to punch somewhere and you need to be able to threaten them somewhere. Tharians do that very well because they have Cleave 3 and they actually have Cleave 3 Line Breaker. So they're probably getting through unless you have Evade, and they have the Brutal Impact, which is going to help them as well. So you have somewhat similar Mahapatis, but a little bit different. So for that, again, and you have some upgrades as well. So if we look at some of the different relics that you can take, obviously you have a banner like, hey, it can help me grab my objectives better. A list like that, the goal is to just sit on the objectives, to outlast, and to be able to just take down the things that you must. The things that will tear through you, take that down. The rest of it, just let it sit there with you. So you take that, hey, +2 for seizing the objectives. And if you're destroyed within range of objective zone, if it can be seized, the controlling player counts as seizing it during the victory phase of that round. So even when you go down, you grab that objective. You can get those last minute points even when you're pretty low. That's the big thing there. I mean, you have some crazy other upgrades like the blades and all and things like that. But we're thinking about more for survivability. You have some other bits like that as well. Different masteries, of course. Vanguard to be able to actually get yourself... there it is. So, in infantry regiments, without the Phalanx Special Rule, marching on the battlefield from reinforcements, gain Vanguard. So, it's active for the duration of the battle, whether or not you're on the field, and any regiments that don't have Phalanx, infantry regiment, I should say, get Vanguard. So, it's not going to help your Phalangites, but it does help a lot of your other units to be able to get them in those positions to just be able to block up the opponent. And you have some other things as well, but again, I'm not going to go into all the little nitty-gritty details in this. Other option I see, obviously, with them is just pure unadulterated combat. A lot of factions have that. You always have abilities to fight, but I want to highlight some of their fighting that they have here. Of particular importance, I want to talk about is some of the brute units. So the Eidolon, or really the brute unit, I guess the Eidolon technically as well. Notice he is allowed to go with an infantry regiment. So if you do want your regiment to have a little bit of something different, you can put him in there. He does have some combat directives, so he can get tons of extra attacks. He can give parry to that unit, which is pretty good on some of these units that have shields and bastion or these sorts of all those sorts of extra rules. Or just punch a cleave. And you could choose that for the turns that you need to, or you got stuck into something that's a problem for you. He does go very good well with Inquisitors, although he doesn't have to go in the Inquisitor unit. What we're looking for here is the sort of predictability. If you're trying to really cut someone down, I think you're looking at trying to have predictable results. Flurry is a great way to get that because you get to reroll. So even if you're only on a 2, even if you're not inspired, 2's rerolling becomes pretty good. If you happen to be on 3's rerolling, now you're about 75% of these attacks. 6 attacks a guy. You're looking at, on average, probably 4 to 5 of them going through on all of them with a cleave of 1. So you are cutting down some armor at least a little bit. And you have some impacts when you end up getting in. 5 resolve means these guys are going to be very, very tough to shift. They will take the wounds, but with 5 wounds, defense 2, again, not that great. But with the 5 resolve, you're kind of only ever taking it on the front end, not so much on the back end, unless they have terrifying or a high level of terrifying. Especially if you're running a bit of a bigger unit with these guys, and they have a good speed. So we're looking at them. We already talked about how the Phalangites can get flurry. So again, you get consistency by having things with flurry. I know there, I want to say, is there another unit that had, I don't remember. It's been a little bit since I've looked at some of these things. Oh, one of the things I'll mention here is the Satori. They have a rule that they arrive from any board edge. excluding your opponent's reinforcement edge, but otherwise, and they ignore all enemy regiments from arriving from reserves and all of that. Can't put any characters in, that's fine. They're regular, they don't help you out with any of that stuff, or where your deployment zones are. But notice they also have Vanguard. So these guys can show up anywhere that you need them. They can start essentially automatically on someone's flank. They could be out positioning your opponent with these guys. You could just, even if you need to, since Vanguard gives you a free additional march, you could absolutely say double march or even triple march to get to the spot that you need, get onto the flank, be able to allow yourself to charge in that following turn. Unfortunately, they can't charge the turn they come in, but that doesn't mean you can't go get to an objective. That doesn't mean you can't actually get behind a unit that's either in combat with you or just barely positioned. The Sleni, there are now your shooting option for this, so that way you have some particular shots. Obviously, you have your chariots who can both hit hard and have some good movement as well. You have your giant monsters, of course. And the other thing, obviously, is that we talked about the Thrynes, which cleave through with a line breaker. They're going to cut through anything you want. So, again, I know there's some upgrades that do it as well. Not exactly that, but we do have ones like for flawless strikes, so that way when you roll the ones, they're not getting anything in terms of defense. Overkill if you're really building someone out to duel, although I don't think they duel, not necessarily amazingly well, not that they duel bad, but I don't know if they have quite the same sort of push, unless the Eidolon can take it. He just takes modifications. Which is fine. That's probably fine. And he has various modifications. You can look through and see the sorts of things that he does as well there. So, all right. Those are sort of the play styles. I know they might not be quite as differentiated, but it also just talks a little bit about some of the units. I mean, these guys now have almost all their stuff other than the chariots, which we've seen are coming out pretty soon. Sacred Band, as far as I know, we have not seen. At least I haven't seen it. And then Clockwork Hoplites, hopefully they'll drop somewhat soon because, the Machinist, and I think it's the Eidolon as well. Yes, they have Carrier of the Godflesh, so you can make Clockwork Hoplites mediums, so you can get them in easier. And while it's on the battlefield, while a friendly regiment activates from your strategic stack, they get hardened plus one. They are slower by minus one. So when you're trying to do that one where you're more survivable, giving your things hardened plus one, but the march minus one, well, my goal is to sit there. My goal is to let you come into me or come into the unit that I'm putting this on because they don't care, and then I can hit you with the rest of what my forces are. Again, remember, when you come in from that, you also then get inspired, and it even works on your unit no matter the rule they have. Let me pull that up just to make sure I have it so that way we can talk about it with this. With Phalanx, so you're going to have that. You could then have your defense 2. You have your Phalanx, so you're counting as defense 3, hardened 1, so effectively you're going to be easier to keep close to 3. Resolve 3, most likely resolve 4, or maybe even better because you're going to have a giant block of these guys together. Although the resolves of your infantry characters. Hallmark, if you have them in there, now you'd be sitting on a 5. You can be a really tough thing to shift. I bring up the Eidolon and the Machinist because that thing is survivable. If we're looking at some of the other ones, it's not that they're perfectly good as well. They just work a little bit different. Strategic stack for the Aristarch, just extra move and things like that. And, you know, and he lets you strategic stack one more time in the total game. Essentially at the start of a round, so you can strategic stack to start off with, which is a great thing to be able to do. Your opponent may not see. Okay. They'll know it can happen because this isn't closed information. They should know what your units do, but they won't know when you're going to do it. And you can then use that. To some extent, it telegraphs your most important turn, at least what you believe to be your most important turn. But that does mean that if you get the first in that turn, you could actually have two units go before they go. Or even if they went first, they do something. Now you could actually have two units and then later store a card. So you're not giving up that early activation to get the unit that you really want into the stack to start with, that one turn when it matters. Let's face it, it's like turn 4 where conquest really happens. Turns 4, 5, and 6 are the main ones. Before that's a lot of jockeying for positioning. After that, it's cleanup. Cleanup for someone. Maybe it's a little bit cleanup on both sides. But it's really probably turns 4, 5, and 6 where the biggest things where you're going to probably win or lose that game or turn it around or kind of give it away to an extent. So that gives a little bit of our play styles. All right, so what I want to go to now then for a moment is just talk about why you might play them or why you should play them. Again, if this interests you. So I'm just going to try to highlight a few key facets that I see of them that might stand out a little bit different. One, if you like, you know, Greek look. So when I got Old Dominion originally, I said, hey, oh, these guys are Romans. That's cool. I didn't realize they were undead at first. I only saw like a small picture. Ah, that's cool. But if you like the Greek or if you like antiquity sort of look, but you don't want to paint a bunch of skeleton or skeleton type things or zombies or, you know, however you want to look at a variety of the things, this is great for you. They have a bunch of different city states, so you can do any sort of color scheme you want. You could also go very classic and do an antiquity sort of look. You could do something from Athens or Sparta. Any of those absolutely fit just fine. I do think the sort of blue and silvers that they do look good, but I've seen a variety of other colors that I think will actually highlight themselves very, very well. So if you like that sort of very classic look, they fit it very well. The other thing is I put these guys down as humans with some fun. The idea of that, you know, when I think of Nords essentially have more of a monster sort of aspect to them. You have you know, your Ugars, you have your Baresarks, your Ulfinjar. You have a lot more sort of out there human faction. You have the Hundred Kingdoms, who's just pure humans. And you have these guys, who are mostly human. Okay, the Brutes and the Clockwork's a little bit different, but otherwise mostly human, with a few of some other things sprinkled in. Some Minotaurs, which again are more classic antiquity ideas. You have Satyrs, more classic antiquity ideas. So you do have a human faction that kind of splits the difference between, you know, the real and the higher fantasy. I see them as a little bit more the mid-fantasy, or also, again, because I don't know if this is maybe a fair way to put it, but I see it as, I don't know if I want to use the word more realistic, but maybe a little bit less out there for me personally. Now, that could also just be because I'm a bigger fan of, you know, Greek and Roman and that sort of stuff than I am for Norse mythology. And maybe that very well could be why, but I find it a little bit, you're going to be more recognizably human with more recognizable pieces to an extent, unless you happen to know a lot of Norse or Scandinavian or Viking sort of things, but that's just me personally. Another good thing about this is they're new and it's a rather complete line. So this is one of the newer factions. This is technically the second newest faction as of time of our recording, which means that all the sculpts are very good. One thing I will say, and I know they're going back and they're going to fix some of that, but some of the other factions, Spires, Hundred Kingdoms, and all that, some of the early models were just very rough. They're both rough to put together. The plastics don't go together that great. They don't say look that great. They're improving a lot of that, and these guys are a testament to the work that they can actually put out because these guys look really, really good. And it's a pretty complete line. You're only missing a few little things, so now you have a lot of options. That's true in a lot of the other factions as well, but especially when you're starting out, it's good to be able to have that choice, and it's good to be able to figure out what you want and be able to just kind of divvy out whatever units you want. You have all your characters, and you have every unit except for three of them, and we know you're getting some of them pretty soon. The other thing is obviously their special rule. If you're a big fan of their special rule, say their strategic stack, if you like the idea of what that does, if you like the idea of being able to delay now to be able to get a bigger bonus later, or if you enjoy that more than what some of the other, I don't want to say gimmick in a derogatory way, but essentially army gimmick. Every army here has a gimmick. They have the, oh yeah, we're lights, mediums, and heavies, but here's our special thing. Because otherwise, that's one of the biggest distinguishing characteristics in all these different armies. If you look through them all, you're going to find some models with some decent cleave. You'll find some decent impact. Everyone's going to have those sorts of things. Everyone's going to have, in general, with a lot of wounds or a lot of attacks, all those things. It's your gimmick, your special thing is what really makes you something different. For why not? Variety. I didn't have great reasons for this because, honestly, I really do like them. I'm just not starting them because Steve has them and I got too many other things to work on. One, cloaks, especially originally, you got hoplites, you got phalangites, you have inquisitors wearing that as well. Satori are somewhat wearing that. Selene are a little bit. Thrakites, I don't believe are, but you have a lot of cloaks. You got a lot of flowing clothes. So when you look at this, it's a lot of metal and cloth. So depending on your desire to paint those sort of things, one, that's just about all you're painting, because most things are pretty heavily covered, at least most of your general infantry. And to me, this is going to be a large block infantry army, which was one of the other potential downsides. I don't feel they run a sort of monster mash well. I think this is one that wants a lot of its infantry. I think you want lots of large amounts of some of those infantry, especially when we take a look at hoplites or phalangites. The Agma potentially as well for what they do. When you look at some of these, I think you're taking large blocks of infantry. So you want to be painting bit of cloth, tons of metal. You could rust them out and things like that, but I think it probably looks better cleanly. There is other factions that do that as well, although they probably have a little too much cloth, or at least a little too much robes, or maybe robe, somewhat robes, but also more of cloaks and things like that to be able to just metal spray them. Like 100 Kingdoms, you could probably just metal spray, go back in, touch up faces, hands, and differentiate the metals a little bit, and most of your infantry are done. These guys, better looking kits, but a lot more little details, a lot more things like that you have to do. So depending on what you like to paint, you're going to paint a lot of infantry here, and you're going to paint a lot of exactly same sort of infantry here. So that's something to consider. I said you're painting a lot of metal, a lot of cloth, very little skin. I said the other thing, which is large blocks of infantry. If you're not the type of person who wants to bring 6 or 7 sizes of some of these units. Not that you'll do it for all of them, but I think when you're talking about phalangites, yeah, I think you're going to want enough to be able to run like a 6-pack. Now you always will, but enough to be able to do that. I think for hoplites, you might want something like that. I think for some of these, this is a faction where you're probably going to be running some of those units a little bit heavier. So unless you're kind of pulling into your brutes and sort of monster type things, obviously. But those might be some, honestly, the weakest. Why not to? Because I don't really have a good reason. Don't play them if you just don't like it. Remember, the least amount that you do in any miniature game you do is play the game. The most amount of stuff you do is building, painting, thinking about it, building lists. Considering that, all of those other aspects, every little bit of this game is so much more time spent than actually playing the game. So when you look at this, you're going to know if you like the idea of it. Their base rule is pretty straightforward, unlike some other factions. So it's a pretty straightforward rule without trying it out much. You should know whether or not that appeals to you. Wadroon, I think you got to proxy them and test them out before you know whether or not their rules fit for you because of how complicated or intense it can be. You know, when you look at a faction like this, I know exactly what I do. Oh, their special rule, very nice and simple. I get to save a card, use a card later. I get to put one of my potentially Minotaur with some certain of my units. Nice and simple. So I think this is a faction where, again, my why nots were probably terrible reasons, and that's absolutely fine. You're going to know if you don't like them. You know yourself, and you know when you try this out, you look at it and say, you know what, no, this isn't for me. Or especially, like I said, if you don't like Greek stuff, if you don't like antiquity, if you don't like those sort of things. So I think this one's a pretty easy, or the one thing I will say, they don't show the pictures here. The other thing is if you don't like the weird chariots, the hitch for the horses is like the tongue of the chariot's face. And that's unsettling to me for reasons I don't understand. So that's potentially a very good reason not to play these guys. All right. So what we want to do now then is just briefly talk about how to kind of get started with them. So, obviously, you have the player kits. Remember, if you are buying this or anything else, we can save you 10%. Helps us out as well. Get you all this, hopefully, good content that you are enjoying. If you are trying to get a friend in, there are two good options to get your friends in. If your friend wants to take more Nordic humans, you obviously have the old two-player starter set. Realize they're putting it at sale. My guess is that's probably going away. I just don't know when. If someone's looking at the Sorcerer Kings for the new one, you do now have the new one. Again, it's a two-player starter set. And it gives some of the Digin, which is new, and it gives you, on this side, some of the little bit of a different of the units that you had. So you have your Ipacaros as your leader. He goes with your unit of Companion Cavalry, your Hoplites and Thoracides. Both things that you want. You want Hoplites or Palangites. You're going to want Thoracides. And then your opponent, probably reasonably balanced. I don't know if it's perfectly balanced, but that's fine. Pretty good starting point. If you really want to, if you know for a fact you want to play these guys and you want to jump in, you know, both feet, waiting for the internet to go here. There you go. Yeah, it took a moment from my computer's freezing up on me. If you really want to get into it, just, you know, sort of all in one. Once this thing loads up, you obviously can get an army all at once. So that's an option for you as well. I said, if you want to go all at once, they have the tip of the spear. So it's a full 2,000-point army. They give you a list of the things they put in this. So they tell you what your three different leaders are. You get two sets of Hoplites. You get two sets of Phalangites. You get two Satori. You get a Festin. You get some Thyrians. So you get, honestly, overall, a pretty good force. You get enough that you can run a nice big block of your Phalangites. You have, like I said, Hoplites. You can run them as a bigger pack or take them as two threes, anything like that you want. You do have some Inquisitors to be able to go with your Eidolon if that's where you want to put him. Otherwise, you can take them as a three pack, put them in with one of the other units because he's allowed to go in with the infantry. You do have some of your Seder boys. Oh, yeah, sorry, those are the Thoracites there. Seder boys are vaguely behind them. It's a little, yeah, they're there. It's a little bit harder to see there. You have some Minotaurs, you got one of the big boys. So it does give you a pretty good force overall. You got a lot of options there. And like I said, we save you 10%, so it actually would save you. If the box already saves you a bunch, but then it saves you an extra box. So you're probably getting about two things for free. Your other option, of course, if you're just wanting to get in a little smaller, but you're not trying to get in halvesies, is that you can go with the one-player starter box. Let's see if this loads up fast. Internet's very... Oh, here we go. It's pretty slow before this. So we click to be able to actually see what's in this particular box just by pictures. What's nice about this is... this one is different than the old one. So if you happen to have the... Oh, no, my apologies. I don't know if they had an old one. That was the two-player, because that's what I had, part of it. So you're getting either 24 Agma or Thoracides. You could do, obviously, 12 and 12, three stands of each. You're getting three stands of Minotaurs, whatever type that you like. You're getting a Polemarch, and you're getting one of the big boys. So this itself, actually... depending on how you, what option you choose for those guys, this is actually reasonably heavy point-wise, because that big guy's pretty expensive. He's like 230 or so, I want to say. And these guys, if you run them as Thyrians, are like 190. So you can bulk this out pretty well. Where to go from there? Let's assume for a second, let's just assume that one player star is a really good spot. If you go for a full army, then you got everything. If you go off of any of the others, what I would say is go for the option that you don't currently possess. So if you're going with this one, let's see. Has an Aristarch in there, or an Aristarch? He takes almost everything, so you could really go with anything you like. I think with that, you probably want something with speed. So maybe Companion Calvert or War Chariots when they come out. So I think those are some pretty good options. You do have those now, so you could get some Cav. Or... you could start going the Eidolon Inquisitor route, so you could go something. So again, you have some decent speed, and you probably from there want to figure out the other units that you want, so that way you can figure out the leader for them, or pick the leader that you like and units that go with them. Another way I would expand that out, if you don't want to be, or you're not sure how to go from there, or you want to kind of keep it small for the moment, another unit of Minotaurs. The problem with only having three... and in that unit, I don't think it matters. But since you can take them sometimes as supports, which neither of these, it was that and Thoracites. Thoracites do take them as supports. So if you're making Thoracites, you want to be able to actually take a Thyrian, which means you don't have enough for a unit. So off of that, if that's your goal, if that's the way you want to build that out, I would go some Minotaurs next. After that, I would figure out the character you like. Or the unit that you like and which character can take that. Like I said, I'm partial probably to the Inquisitors and the Eidolon. Again, he doesn't have to go with them, which gives me some options. But I like to be able to expand out to a little bit of Brutes. Or, like I said, you could easily go with the Mechanist or Machinist or an Aerostarch. Either one of those to be able to branch out. The Mechanist, I really do like his Warlord ability, his Supremacy. So I think he's a pretty good option to end up being able to take as well. So Phalangites, I think sooner or later you're going to want a good amount of those, because I have a hard time seeing a list of theirs that doesn't run a brick. And the brick doesn't have to be six big, but at least like a four brick. I'd run it by two, keep my profile pretty small, go sit on the objective, point in direction of enemy, maybe angle, ideally a somewhat side objective, so you can angle yourself appropriately, so that way they can't necessarily hit you on the sides well. And that way they'll get to the front, because if you angle straight forward, maybe they come around this way. If you angle a little bit, it could still be tough for them to get here, just because of board edge or position. And then you're hitting the front, they're losing a lot of their bonuses, they're not really getting that much. And then when you hit back with pretty much everything you already have. So overall, that's the city-states. Hopefully this was informative. Hopefully this was useful. I know for some of these pieces, I just like them in general. So I have a hard time saying, oh, don't do this for this reason, because I just think they're really cool. So I think every faction's reasonably cool, but some of them I wouldn't want to play because they personally don't fit my style. These guys do, because I like the idea of a chunky block of infantry to do something. I like taking blocks of four, five, and six for my infantry in my current Sorcerer Kings list. I'm taking the goals in sixes, two packs of sixes currently, because that's enough to get something done, and I just enjoy it. So I think this is a faction that takes very well to those large bricks. So they fit my playstyle. Large bricks with good brutes, that's what I like. Giant monsters, I could take or leave. In general, I do like them, in this list, they're very, very good. But for my purposes, I'm okay if my list doesn't have a giant monster in it personally. So they do fit exactly what I personally like. All right, that gives us most of the factions. Next one up is Dwig. My goal is to record that this week. I should be able to. I'm pretty much done all my research with them. I actually just had to sit down and do it. My hope is maybe tomorrow morning I'll do that, although it won't come out probably till later in the week. So we have that. Like I said, I will do one of these for Sorcerer Kings. I don't know if I want to do it right now since I just did all that coverage. I think I want to maybe wait. At least want to wait until they finalize the rules. We know some changes they're doing. If you don't, I made a short video about rules changes that are coming up. But I think I want to wait until that's out so I can feel a little bit more definitive. I don't want to record a video about them and then they change them immediately because they're brand new and things could change pretty fast. For other things from us, like I said, if you're watching this close to when it gets put out on the 14th of April in Maplewood, New Jersey, we are having a tournament for Conquest. You can find about it on our Discord. I'll try to remember to post it in the show notes as well. So if you happen to be local to us, come on out. We'd love to see more people. If the rules changes for Sorcerer Kings drop in time, I'll be taking them. If not, I'm probably just taking my old Dominion. Reason being, I'm not expecting with so little options that Sorcerer Kings would win me this thing. That's not why I'm doing it. But I want to feel like I compete. And I feel until that Bloodlust change, since almost every unit out right now is Bloodlust, other than, you know, your Rajakur, rather than the people standing there, everyone else is Bloodlust, I don't think it's going to do well. And pull a ritual card, how there's my turn, that's really slow. And it's going to slow you down too much. So I think right now they're honestly in a really bad place. With those fixes, I think they're in a good place. I think they compete very well. And again, it's early on. Like, I'm missing units that realistic other people have that fulfill roles that I can't fulfill. So if I'm already, you know, kind of down because I can't fit all my roles, I also don't want to be down because my guys are going to walk away or try, you know, needing a six charges and slowing down because my rituals go off and I do nothing else. So if they get those rule changes in time, I'm playing it. Otherwise, I'll probably just bring my old Dominion and then the next tournament, hopefully in about maybe May or early June, bring them then. I know there's some other stores around us. I know at least Wargamers Guild, I think they have one. It's further south in Jersey. They have one in May, I believe. So if you're close to that area, absolutely go there. They have a great community for it. And I know further up north, Rogue State Gaming, they're another store that has a very good community. I don't know when their next tournament is. I know they're going to have one. I just don't know when it is. So my hope is to be able to travel to those, but also be able to get some of those players traveling as well. Because, you know, we're actually not, in general, at least from Maywood in the middle, we're not that far from each other. So it really helps build that community. I'll probably do everything about building communities and all for games, but the biggest thing is get players moving. That's what builds a community. We just had a 40K event, and what really helped is people showed up from other places. They show up from from other spots, and then you come and you talk and you make friends in those spots. And then, I didn't know you guys did this over there. Hey, when you do it, I'm going to go over and see it and spend money there and help build interest. All of that helps. Two stores are only competing if they're like right next to each other. If you're talking about for events and things like that, you're not competition. Don't schedule events at the same time as the other store on the same sort of day. That's why we do ours on different days. We talk to each other because getting players to move back and forth helps everyone. Because now more people are interested. It gets more popular. We sometimes have people randomly show up and say, what are you doing today? Oh, we're playing in a tournament. Oh, there's a lot of people here because they're coming from all over. Oh, this game's actually popular. I have a bunch of places I can go to play this because maybe our night is like a Friday night, but your night's a Tuesday night. Hey, they have Tuesday off. Guess what? They're going to you. You know, that's a good thing. Those are the things you want. So we have that. Out of that, I'm hoping to record 2 to 3 battle reports off of that. I probably won't be playing all of them, so some of them might be just the players kind of going through it, but I do want to do that. And then hoping to get some more content out related to all that. As I build up my Sorcerer Kings, you'll see more of those. And hopefully get up to play Steve with his city-states so we can see them in some more action. If you're interested in any other particular content related to Conquest, just post it in the comments below. Let me know what it is that you're looking for. Whatever it is that you're looking for, we'll put it up. I will be putting stuff out in Podcatcher as well. Just go to YouTube. That'll put some comments in if there's anything you'd like to see. The more you guys tell us that you want to see, the more of the things we know what to do with. I want to get back to my unit reviews. I have a little bit more for Old Dominion to go through, but I want to test out the units first, and they're dropping soon, so I might talk about another faction first, then finish those ones out, because it doesn't do any good unless we actually test it out. I don't like talking about things if I haven't either played against it or played it or anything like that. That's why the next faction I'm probably going to start going unit by unit through is probably not Sorcerer Kings until we see a little bit more, until I play them a little bit more, but it will probably end up being Spires because they're the next one that I probably have, you know, most comfort with in terms of played them, play against them, seen their tricks and things like that. So, and I know when we get to other factions like this, I know that Steve's going to want to be involved, so we'll make sure we have him involved as well. All right, that belabors all the points that I have long enough. So on behalf of everyone here at the show, has a good hobby, it's a great gaming.